about what if your boss's midnight email, the one demanding an immediate response about a project that isn't actually due for 3 weeks, does the exact same physiological damage to your body as like smoking half a pack of cigarettes?
Right. I mean, it sounds like complete hyperbole when you frame it that way. But biologically, the mechanisms just aren't as different as we've been led to believe.
Which is wild to think about.
It is.
Right.
Because the body doesn't categorize stress into neat little folders labeled, psychological and chemical. It just registers a threat.
And that immediately breaks the model of medicine most of us grew up with, right? I mean, we're so used to this engineering approach. You break your arm, the x-ray shows a jagged white line, and the doctor points to it and says, well, there it is. It's
Yeah.
totally binary. Broken or not broken, fixed or not fixed.
And that model is incredibly comforting, honestly, because it relies on localized, visible pathology. Like if you have acute appendicitis, you absolutely want that mechanistic, localized approach. You want the surgeon to just get in there and remove the inflamed tissue.
Yeah, for sure.
But the problem arises when we take that acute care paradigm and attempt to overlay it onto neurodevelopment or trauma,
Yeah.
or the massive spectrum of chronic diseases we face today. Suddenly, the x-ray machine is just useless.
Right, because the boundaries blur.
Exactly. The causes aren't localized anymore. They're systemic.
And that feeling, that persistent sense that something is fundamentally missing in how we talk about being healthy or being sick, that is exactly why we are jumping into today's deep dive.
Yeah, we have a really fascinating source to unpack
We
today.
do. We're looking at a comprehensive 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bichara Saheli. It's titled A Life Coherent Framework for Health, Healing, and Human Flourishing. And the mission for this deep dive is pretty ambitious.
It really is.
We are going to fundamentally rewire how you, the listener, think about your own health. We're moving entirely away from the narrow, outdated idea that health is simply the absence of disease.
Which is how most of us define it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Instead, we are exploring a unified six-level theory of what this paper calls life capacity. So we're going to start at the microscopic level, like the very organelles inside your cells, and trace those connections all the way up to massive civilizational systems.
And, to really appreciate the necessity of this shift, we have to look soberly at where we are right now. Like, we possess highly advanced medical technologies. We've achieved extraordinary things in pharmacology and surgical intervention and infection control.
Unbelievable things, really.
Right. Yet, we're simultaneously witnessing these unprecedented rises in chronic illnesses, autoimmune conditions, metabolic syndrome, and systemic burnout. So our technical successes are kind of accompanied by this dangerous conceptual narrowing.
Well, I want to push back on that almost immediately, actually, because if our medical science is so advanced, like if we can edit genes and transplant entire organs, why do we need to bring philosophy and societal architecture into a discussion about whether I'm healthy?
That's the common objection,
I
yeah.
mean, isn't health just having good biomarkers on a blood test?
Well, the blood test is a snapshot of an end state, right? But it tells you very little about the ecosystem that actually produced that state. Right now, our approach to human suffering is severely fragmented.
How so?
Well, if you present with a biological disease, you're routed to a medical doctor. But if you express emotional distress, you are sent to psychiatry or psychology. And if you live in a neighborhood with, like, toxic air, well, that's relegated to environmental policy or urban planning.
Oh, I see.
And if your diet is poor, society basically dumps that entirely onto your individual willpower.
So we basically split the human experience into bureaucratic
We
departments.
do. We absolutely do.
Okay.
But the human organism does not experience these inputs in separate departments.
Yeah.
You receive the air pollution and the financial distress, the ultra-processed food, and the social isolation at the exact same moment.
Wow, yeah.
The organism metabolizes its environment, what biologists call its niche, as one single, continuous, unified reality. So the separation is just an administrative fiction. The biological reality is complete integration.
So the traditional view treats the human body like a car engine. You take it to a mechanic, they isolate the malfunctioning spark plug, replace it, and just send you on your way.
Right.
But the life coherent framework Dr. Saheli proposes, it seems to treat the body much more like a living sponge sitting in a fish tank.
Oh, I like that.
Like you can take the sponge out of the tank, surgically repair a torn piece of it, and place it back in. But if the water it's continually absorbing is saturated with toxins, you haven't actually restored health. You just patch the sponge while totally ignoring the water.
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it. And it highlights exactly why the paper defines health not as the absence of pathology, but as life capacity enabled.
Life capacity. Okay, what does that mean practically?
Life capacity is the real lived ability of persons and communities to develop, repair, relate, learn, and participate within the web of life.
Mm-hmm.
So healing is the active restoration of that specific capacity.
So it's not just a biological baseline. It actually includes dignity and agency and belonging. Now, to keep an idea this massive from just floating away into abstract theory, the paper anchors it with three very specific philosophical guardrails. So let's dig into the first one, which is McMurtry's Life Value Foundation.
Right. So John McMurtry's work forces us to ask a primary orienting question about literally any system. Does this system, policy, or societal arrangement expand or reduce the capacities required for a good human life?
Okay.
It places life itself as the ultimate metric of value rather than, you know, financial profit or administrative efficiency.
Can you give me a tangible example of how that changes our perspective?
Sure. Consider an economic system that shows massive GDP growth. But it achieves that growth by degrading the bodies of its workers through relentless hours or by extracting resources in a way that poisons local watersheds.
So under a standard economic metric, that system is highly successful.
Exactly. But under McMurtry's Life Value Foundation, it is creating profound disvalue. It is fundamentally destructive because it actively reduces the life capacity of the organisms living within it.
Man, that's powerful. And that leads directly into the second guardrail, which is Humberto Maturana's concept of structural coupling, which I have to say sounds incredibly dense.
It does sound like a mouthful.
But it's essentially the scientific explanation of our sponge and fish tank analogy, right?
It really is. Maturana was a biologist who emphasized that living beings are not closed systems. We are not isolated, self-contained units. We survive through a continuous dynamic coupling with the conditions that sustain us.
We're connected to everything.
Exactly. We are structurally coupled to oxygen, to atmospheric pressure, to a specific range of temperatures. We're coupled to the microbes in the soil, to the food we ingest. And crucially for humans, we are structurally coupled to culture, language, and social structures.
So we are defined by our relationships to our inputs. And if the inputs change, our structure literally has to change to adapt.
Spot on. And that adaptation brings us to the third and probably the most provocative guardrail, Johan Galtung's concept of violence.
Now, hold on a second. Because when people hear the word violence, they immediately think of a physical assault, a mugging, a punch in the face, a war.
Of course.
If we start broadening the word violence to include, like, having a long commute or living in a bad economy, don't we completely dilute what the word means?
Feels that way at first until you look at the biological outcomes. Galtung differentiated between direct violence, which is the intentional, visible perpetrator throwing a punch, and structural or cultural violence.
Okay, define structural violence for me.
Structural violence refers to the preventable harms that are just built into the everyday architecture of our society.
So like unsafe housing, food apartheid, toxic chemical exposures, or humiliating bureaucratic systems.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Think about a marginalized community that is placed intentionally next to a heavy industrial zone. The children in that community develop severe chronic asthma at like five times the rate of children just a few miles away. Their life capacity is physically restricted. Their lung tissue is literally scarred. They lose days of schooling, which alters their entire developmental trajectory. There is no single person standing there punching them in the chest, but their bodies are sustaining profound, measurable structural injury.
And Galtung argues that treating this as just an unfortunate circumstance rather than a form of violence protects the system that created the arrangement in the first place.
That
is heavy. So under this definition, a technically successful medical intervention might entirely fail to restore health. Like, say a patient goes in for an oncology surgery. The tumor is successfully removed. The surgeon declares the operation a massive triumph.
Right.
But the patient is then saddled with hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical debt. They lose their home, and the resulting chronic stress prevents their immune system from ever fully recovering. So mechanical fix worked, but the structural violence of the economic aftermath keeps their life capacity completely suppressed.
Yes. The organism is still trapped in a threatening niche. And to truly understand how this works, we need a really precise biological vocabulary. We need terms that describe the biological processes happening inside the patient and the environmental conditions happening outside in their life world.
Which is where we get to the two bookends of healing. Salagenesis and salutogenesis. They sound like twins, but they operate in totally different domains.
They do.
So let's start with the internal biology, which is salagenesis.
Right. So the term salagenesis was developed by Dr. Robert Nauvio. Modern medicine is exceptionally skilled at understanding pathogenesis, right? How diseases start and how they cause damage. But Nauvio asked a completely different question. What must the organism actually do biologically to complete the process of healing?
Because we usually think of healing as just a passive return to normal once the bad thing is gone, like the disease simply evaporating.
Yeah, and it is anything but passive. Cell genesis is a highly orchestrated, energy-intensive, resource-consuming cycle. Nauvio posits that it begins with something called the cell danger response, or CDR.
The cell danger response.
Yes. When a cell detects a threat, and that threat can be a virus, a chemical toxin, physical trauma, or even severe psychological stress, it fundamentally alters its metabolism. It shifts away from ordinary growth, housekeeping, and communication. It basically circles the wagons. It prioritizes defense, containment, and sheer survival.
Okay, let's get specific about that mechanism. What does circling the wagons actually look like inside a single cell?
Well, one major shift involves ATP. Adenosine triphosphate. Mm-hmm. We know ATP as the energy currency inside the cell. Mm. But during the cell danger response, the cell will actively leak ATP into the extracellular space.
Wait, it leaks its own energy?
Yes, because outside the cell, ATP acts as a powerful warning signal. It's a damage-associated molecular pattern. It tells every neighboring cell, hey, we're under attack, shut the doors. And this initiates the next phase of the healing cycle, which is inflammation.
Now, public health messaging constantly tells us that inflammation is the enemy, right? We take anti-inflammatory pills, we buy anti-inflammatory foods, we treat it like a mistake the body is making.
Which is a profound misunderstanding of biology. Inflammation is not a mistake. It is an absolutely necessary first step of healing. It isolates the threat, it recruits immune cells to the area to clear out cellular debris, and it sends chemical signals that say, we need raw materials here to rebuild.
But the cycle obviously can't stall there.
Precisely. If the threat is resolved, the cell danger signals turn off. Then the cycle moves to proliferation, where new tissue is actively rebuilt. And finally, it enters differentiation, where those newly built cells learn their specific jobs and reintegrate into the whole organ system. They return to functional coherence.
But that whole process must be exhausting.
It is. That entire sequence requires massive amounts of energy, raw materials, and a biological signal that the environment is finally safe.
Okay, so salagenesis is the internal construction crew. They secure the site, they tear down the damaged walls, they build new ones, and they paint.
Exactly.
But then we have the other bookend, salutogenesis, which focuses on the external environment, the city surrounding the construction site.
Right. Salutogenesis was coined by a medical sociologist named Aaron Antonosky. He researched trauma survivors and asked simply, what creates health? And he discovered that an individual ability to maintain health relies heavily on their environment, providing a sense of coherence.
Meaning the world around them isn't sheer chaos.
Exactly. It has three components. The environment must be comprehensible, meaning you can understand what is happening to you, and predict how things generally work. It must be manageable, so you have access to the resources required to meet the demands placed upon you. And it must be meaningful. You feel that engaging with these demands is actually worth your emotional and physical investment.
And what actually provides that sense of coherence?
What Antonosky called resistance resources. These can be broad structural resources like a stable income, safe housing, clean air, and a culture of trust. Or they can be highly specific, like access to a particular medication or a strong friendship you can rely on during a crisis.
So connecting the two bookends here, salagenesis is the internal construction crew. They are primed and ready to rebuild the damaged tissue, but salutogenesis is the city's external supply chain.
Yes.
So if the city outside stops delivering bricks, or worse, if the city keeps sending wrecking balls into the side of the house every single day, the internal construction crew never finishes the job. They just stay in emergency mode forever.
You have just perfectly described the life-coherent view of chronic disease.
Wow.
Chronic disease is often a salagenic healing cycle that got stuck or blocked. If the outer environment continuously signals danger through relentless financial stress or ongoing exposure to pollutants, profound social isolation, or systemic injustice, the inner biology physically cannot move past the inflammation phase.
So the cell danger response just stays locked in the on position?
Yes. The mitochondria keep signaling danger, the body keeps producing inflammatory cytokines, the construction crew stays in demolition mode. This completely shifts the paradigm. because it removes the blame from the patient.
Right.
The patient doesn't have a fundamentally defective body that is failing to heal. Their body is performing a highly logical, adaptive response to an environment that absolutely refuses to provide safety or resources. You cannot complete biological repair if your structural niche is actively hostile.
This fundamentally alters how we view chronic illness. It's not a breakdown of the machine. It's a perfectly functioning alarm system that nobody is turning off.
That's exactly it.
To really map how this danger signal cascades, let's take a journey through Dr. Sahili's six-level architecture. We are going to start at the absolute microscopic basement and work our way up to the edges of human civilization. Level one is cellular and biological architecture.
And we must start here because all the high-level sociological concepts like agency, dignity, structural violence, they eventually have to be translated into the physical reality of living cells. The life-coherent framework is deeply grounded in biology, and at the absolute center of this level are the mitochondria.
Okay, let's pause on the mitochondria, because the textbook model we all learned in high school is that they are just the powerhouses of the cell. They take in glucose and oxygen and spit out ATP for energy. But you're suggesting they act more like the cell's homeland security department.
There's a much more accurate paradigm, yeah. Yes, they produce ATP, but they are incredibly sophisticated metabolic sensors. They are constantly sampling the cytosolic environment for signs of safety or danger.
What are they looking for?
They monitor changes in temperature, pH levels, the presence of viral RNA, the influx of heavy metals, and even the chemical signatures of psychological stress hormones.
Wait, are you saying our microscopic cells can essentially taste the stress or the air pollution in our environment?
Literally, yes. Through a process called transduction.
Yeah.
When you inhale particulate matter from diesel exhaust, or when you experience the sheer panic of an eviction notice, those events do not remain outside of you. The diesel particulates enter the bloodstream and interact with cellular membranes. The panic triggers a cascade of hormones that bathe your tissues. The mitochondria sense these chemical changes. And if the threat is severe or chronic, the mitochondria deliberately alter their shape. They fragment. And they shift the cell into that defense mode we discussed.
So they intentionally dial down cellular energy production.
Yes, to conserve resources for survival.
Which perfectly explains the profound, crushing fatigue associated with so many chronic and autoimmune diseases. It's not that you are just tired. Your mitochondria have actively initiated an energy brownout to protect the organism from what they perceive as a systemic threat.
Exactly.
And level one includes other mechanisms too, right? Like redox balance and proteostasis. Let's unpack the mechanisms there. How does an external threat disrupt redox balance?
Well, redox balance refers to the intricate flow of electrons in the body, oxidation and reduction reactions. When mitochondria are producing energy efficiently, they handle electrons safely. But when they're under chronic stress from toxins, poor diet, or relentless psychosocial strain, they become inefficient. They start leaking unpaired electrons. We call these free radicals or reactive oxygen species.
And those unpaired electrons are unstable. They want to pair up, so they start stealing electrons from other structures in the cell.
Exactly. They rip electrons from the cell membrane's lipids, which is called lipid peroxidation. They rip them from proteins, changing their shirt. They even rip them from your DNA, causing mutations. This state is called oxidative stress, and it ties directly into proteostasis.
Proteostasis being the cell's internal housekeeping.
Yes, the maintenance of proteins. Proteins have to be folded into very specific, complex 3D shapes to do their jobs, whether they are enzymes, structural fibers, or receptors. Folding proteins perfectly requires massive amounts of energy. So when the cell is in danger mode, energy is diverted. Proteins start to misfold.
And a misfolded protein is basically just cellular garbage.
It's actually worse than garbage. It can become toxic. Usually the cell has mechanisms like autophagy or the ubiquitin proteasome system to tag and shred these damaged proteins. But if the cell is chronically stressed and starved of energy by its own mitochondria, the housekeeping systems fail.
So the trash just piles up.
Right. Misfolded proteins clump together into aggregates. We see this exact mechanism in neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. The cell literally chokes on its own accumulated damage because it never got the all-clear signal to resume housekeeping.
It's like being under siege. If you're constantly fending off invaders at the front gate, you don't have the time or the manpower to take out the trash in the kitchen. Eventually, the house just becomes uninhabitable.
That's a great way to put it.
And then there is epigenetic regulation. This is the mechanism by which the environment actually talks to our genes.
Yeah, we used to think the DNA code was an immutable destiny. But epigenetics shows that while the code doesn't change, the expression of that code is highly dynamic. Environmental inputs like nutrition, exposure to pollutants, the quality of caregiving in infancy, chronic stress, they add chemical tags like methyl groups to the DNA.
And these tags act like volume knobs, turning certain genes up and silencing others.
Yes. If an environment is chronically hostile, epigenetic changes will upregulate pro-inflammatory genes to keep the immune system primed and downregulate antiviral or tissue repair genes. The cell is deeply historical. It maintains a molecular memory of what it has been exposed to.
Which transitions us beautifully into level 2 organismal systems integration. Because these cells aren't just rogue entities operating in a vacuum. They're organized into tissues, organs, and massive regulatory circuits. The human body is a dynamic regulatory ecology.
We have to move past the idea that we are just a collection of isolated organs.
Mm-hmm.
A heart in the chest, a brain in the skull, a liver in the abdomen. These systems are in constant, instantaneous dialogue. Take the HPA axis, for instance, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. This is our primary stress response pathway.
Let's trace that mechanism. What actually happens when a threat is perceived?
Well, the hypothalamus in the brain detects a threat and releases a hormone called CRH. That signals the pituitary gland to release ACTH, which travels all the way down to the adrenal gland sitting on top of your kidneys. Then the adrenals release cortisol and adrenaline.
And cortisol gets a really bad reputation, but it's not inherently evil, right? I mean, we need it to survive.
It is absolutely essential. It mobilizes glucose into the bloodstream so your muscles have energy to run or fight. It sharpens focus. It temporarily suppresses digestion and reproduction because, you know, you don't need to digest a sandwich if you're running from a predator.
Right. Fair point.
In acute doses, it is life-saving. But the problem is chronic activation. If you are constantly forced to adapt to conditions that are relentless, like working for a profoundly abusive manager, facing systemic discrimination, or navigating the threat of eviction, your HPA axis never gets to turn off.
Which leads to a concept the paper highlights, allostatic load.
Right. Allostasis is the process of maintaining stability through change. It's the body altering its set points to meet demands. But allostatic load is the cumulative biological wear and tear of having to repeatedly adapt to stress.
The compounding cost.
Exactly. Over time, the constant flood of cortisol causes the receptors in your tissues to become insensitive. You develop glucocorticoid resistance. The body actually loses its regulatory flexibility.
You essentially burn out the shock absorbers. A tiny bump in the road suddenly causes the entire chassis to rattle.
Yes. And we see this mirrored in the autonomic nervous system. We have the sympathetic branch, which is the fight or flight accelerator, and the parasympathetic branch, the rest and digest brake, which is governed largely by the vagus nerve. We can measure the dynamic balance between these two through heart rate variability, or HRV.
Okay, so high HRV means your heart can rapidly adjust its rhythm based on immediate needs. It's flexible. But low HRV means your heart rate is rigid, like it's locked into a state of vigilance.
Exactly. If your structural environment is constantly demanding, your vagal tone drops. The brake is basically removed. You are locked in sympathetic dominance. You physically cannot shift into the physiological state required for deep sleep, digestion, and cellular repair. And this systemic integration extends to the microbiome, too.
The microbiome is such a fascinating boundary layer. It's wild to consider that a massive portion of our health relies on an entirely different kingdom of life coexisting inside our digestive tract.
It really is. Mm-hmm. We are superorganisms. We host trillions of microbes. And they don't just sit there. They are active regulatory partners. They digest fibers we cannot break down, synthesizing short-chain fatty acids like butyrate, which provide energy to the cells lining our colon. And crucially, they educate our immune system, teaching it the difference between a harmless food particle and a dangerous pathogen.
But how does stress or an external exposure disrupt that? Like, how does anxiety reach my gut?
It's bidirectional communication. When you are under severe psychological stress, the altered vagal tone and stress hormones actually change the motility of your gut. They change the pH. This alters the environment, causing beneficial bacteria to die off and allowing opportunistic pathogenic bacteria to flourish. These pathogens can then degrade the tight junctions between the cells of your intestinal lining.
Oh, the dreaded leaky gut scenario.
Correct. Intestinal permeability. When those junctions break, molecules like lipopolysaccharides, which are toxins from bacterial cell walls, slip across the barrier into the bloodstream. The immune system detects them and triggers massive systemic inflammation.
Wow.
So the outer environmental stress altered the microbial ecosystem, which broke the physical barrier, which caused widespread systemic inflammation, which then crosses the blood-brain barrier and causes neuroinflammation, presenting as depression or brain fog. It is a recursive integrated cascade. You cannot fix the depression without addressing the gut, and you cannot fix the gut without addressing the psychosocial stress that initiated the shift in motility.
The cascade connects everything. So we've covered the cellular basement in level one and the organ systems on the ground floor in level two. Let's pull back the lens to levels three and four, where the mind, the physical body, and the timeline of our lives all intersect. Level three is psychosocial and behavioral transduction. Simply put, how lived experience becomes biology.
This is where biography becomes biology. We tend to think of emotions like humiliation, exclusion, or grief as abstract, ethereal experiences happening in a non-physical mind. But the brain is an organ of neuroception.
Uh-huh.
It's constantly scanning the social environment for safety or threat.
So a toxic workplace or systemic racism isn't just making you feel bad emotionally, it is initiating a physical transduction process.
Yes, it is. When a person appraises a situation as threatening, uncontrollable, or deeply unjust, it activates the precise neuroendocrine and immune pathways we just outlined. There's a phenomenon called the conserved transcriptional response to adversity, or CTRA. Researchers have found that individuals experiencing chronic social isolation or threat show a specific genomic profile. Their genes for inflammation are aggressively dialed up, and their genes for antiviral defense are dialed down.
Meaning the feeling of loneliness literally changes how your DNA fights off a virus. That is staggering.
It really is.
And this deeply challenges how public health usually talks about lifestyle choices. We tend to look at diet, exercise, or smoking as isolated moral decisions. But this framework calls them situated adaptations.
Situated adaptations radically changes the framing. It suggests that human behaviors are not random acts of individual willpower or failure. They are logical attempts to cope with the environment the organism is forced to navigate.
Let's run a hypothetical example to ground this. Say you have someone working two precarious gig economy jobs. Their schedule changes every week. They have chronic financial anxiety, they sleep 4 hours a night, and they live in an area where the only accessible food is a corner store selling ultra-processed commodities. At the end of a grueling 14-hour day, they buy a massive sugary soda and a bag of chips. Under the old model, a doctor looks at that and says, well, you lack discipline. You are making bad choices.
And that doctor would be utterly failing to understand human biology. The patient's HPA axis is exhausted. Their prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain responsible for long-term planning and impulse control, is structurally starved of energy due to sleep deprivation and allostatic load. They have zero time or energy to cook. Grabbing hyperpalatable, highly processed food is a perfectly rational, situated adaptation to get a massive, immediate infusion of glucose and a fleeting hit of dopamine just to survive the evening.
Substance use fits here too, doesn't it? It's not a moral feeling. It's a desperate attempt to biochemically regulate untreated pain, complex trauma, or the sheer despair of a hostile niche.
Exactly. When you tell a person in that situation to just join a gym and eat more kale, you are not providing care. You are providing cognitive burden. You are moralizing their behavior while remaining completely blind to the structural forces that make those behaviors necessary for their immediate coping. Sir Michael Marmot's extensive research on health inequalities demonstrated this beautifully. The degree of control and agency you have over your own life is one of the most powerful determinants of your biological health. When you strip people of agency, their biological regulation breaks down.
Which brings us to level four, life course and intergenerational embedding. Health isn't a static snapshot of your biology at 3:00 p.m. on a Tuesday. It is a trajectory over an entire lifespan, heavily shaped by critical developmental windows.
The life course perspective recognizes that our biological margins are built over time. And it starts before conception. The nutritional status, toxic exposures, and cumulative stress levels of parents directly affect the reproductive gametes. Then, pregnancy is a profound window of structural plasticity.
We're talking about fetal programming here.
Yes. The developing fetus is essentially running a continuous query on the maternal environment to figure out what kind of world it is about to enter. If the mother is experiencing severe nutritional scarcity or the crushing allostatic load of intimate partner violence, the placenta transmits those stress signals to the fetus. The fetus adapts. It alters its own developing metabolism to hoard calories, assuming it will be born into a famine environment. It wires its own tiny HPA axis to be hypervigilant, assuming it will be born into a war zone.
Okay, I want to stop and challenge this because this territory can feel incredibly fatalistic. If fetal programming and early childhood trauma are so structurally determinative, Are we basically saying that if you had a chaotic childhood, your adult biology is permanently ruined? Are we just locking people into a destiny of chronic disease and blaming mothers for being stressed?
That is the most important pushback to offer, absolutely. The Life Coherent Framework explicitly rejects fatalism. The concept of biological plasticity does not slam shut the moment you turn 5 years old. Development remains open. The point of identifying these sensitive windows, like fetal development, infancy, but also adolescence and midlife transitions, is not to declare anyone damaged. It is to recognize that severe early adversity creates biological vulnerabilities that require specific targeted support.
It's identifying the cracks in the foundation so you know where to pour the reinforcement concrete.
Exactly. A hyperreactive stress response wired in childhood can be remodeled. Deeply protective relationships, secure adult environments, somatic therapies, and institutional support can provide the biological safety signals needed to downregulate those defensive epigenetic marks. But it requires society to acknowledge the reality of the embedding. We carry history in our bodies.
And it extends intergenerationally. The trauma of systemic racism, the physiological impact of wealth inequality, the loss of indigenous land. These historical events are transmitted socially, culturally, and directly into the epigenetic and physiological resilience of the next generations.
Which means true preventive medicine isn't just screening adults for high cholesterol. True preventive medicine is ensuring that every infant is born into secure housing, that every parent has paid family leave, and that early childhood nutrition is guaranteed. That is not just social welfare. That is the construction of biological infrastructure.
If our behaviors are situated adaptations and our biology is molded by our life course, we need to take a really hard look at the situation we are forced to adapt to. This brings us to level 5, the architecture of everyday life, or what Dr. Sali calls the salutogenic affordance field.
Right, so the concept of an affordance field comes from ecological psychology. It refers to the surrounding pattern of conditions that make certain actions easy, intuitive, and safe, while making other actions grueling, invisible, or dangerous. It is the physical and social architecture of your daily existence.
Let's ground this with the architecture of a city. Let's look at the concept of desire paths in urban design. You know when urban planners build a paved sidewalk that takes a sharp 90-degree angle around a lawn, but people naturally just walk diagonally across the grass, wearing a dirt path into the ground? The paved road is the intended behavior, but the dirt path, the desire path, is the affordance of least resistance.
That's a fantastic analogy. Now apply that to health. Does your physical environment afford safe movement? Are there shaded sidewalks, low traffic speeds, well-lit parks, and a culture of social trust? In that environment, taking a 30-minute evening walk is the path of least resistance. But what if your neighborhood is dissected by a 6-lane arterial highway with no crosswalks, high violent crime rates, and zero tree canopy?
Right.
In that environment, staying locked inside on the couch is the path of least resistance. It is the safest adaptation to a hostile affordance field.
It applies to the food environment, too. Does your neighborhood afford nourishment? Are there accessible, affordable markets selling whole foods? Or does your environment exclusively afford ultra-processed, highly subsidized commodities engineered to hijack your dopamine receptors, pushed by aggressive commercial marketing?
It applies to the workplace as well. Does your job afford sleep and recovery? Do you have predictable hours and psychological safety? Or does your employer demand constant availability, utilize surveillance software to track your keystrokes, and threaten your livelihood for minor infractions?
So, giving someone a pamphlet on healthy eating when they live in a food desert and work 80 hours a week is like telling someone to swim laps, but the pool is filled with syrup and there's a shark in it.
Exactly.
It is placing the immense burden of systemic failure squarely onto the shoulders of individual willpower.
The central idea here is the principle of ease. A life-coherent society is deliberately structured to make health-supporting behaviors the absolute easiest default choice. It should not require heroic, exhausting, continuous mental discipline for a human being to drink clean water, eat real food, sleep 8 hours, and move their body safely. Those should be the foundational affordances of the society.
This brings up one of the most powerful concepts in the entire white paper, temporal sovereignty.
Meaningful control over your own time. Time is a deeply underrecognized structural determinant of biological health. Without temporal sovereignty, virtually all health advice becomes inaccessible.
Let's expand on the physiological cost of time scarcity.
Well, if you do not own your time, if you are commuting 2 hours each way on underfunded public transit, working unpredictable shift schedules, and acting as the primary caregiver for an aging parent, you exist in a state of chronic temporal compression. You know exactly how to cook a nutritious meal, but you literally do not have the time to prep it. You know you need 8 hours of sleep, but the math of your day physically prevents it.
Time scarcity forces the organism to stay in that sympathetic, dominant, high cortisol survival mode we talked about in level two. Time scarcity turns health knowledge into a psychological burden because you know what you should be doing, but structural reality forbids it, leading to guilt and shame.
Exactly. And that hostile affordance field is not an accident. It is constructed, which forces us to pan the camera out to the absolute widest lens. Level six, the ultimate ecosystem, the life ground, and the civilizational niche. The rules that govern our time, our food, and our neighborhoods are dictated by massive, invisible civilizational engines.
We are talking about the overarching macro systems, global economic models, legal frameworks, agricultural subsidies, and geopolitics.
We have to stop viewing the economy as separate from public health. An economic system is, fundamentally, a health system. It organizes how human beings access the material conditions of life. If an economic model demands endless exponential financial growth and achieves that growth by relentlessly externalizing its true costs, meaning it generates profit by exploiting gig workers, polluting local watersheds with industrial runoff, and flooding the market with cheap, metabolically destructive food, then that economy is a massive, health-disabling machine.
This is where planetary health intersects with human biology. The Rockefeller Foundation Lancet Commission made this explicit a few years ago. We achieved significant public health gains in the 20th century, but we bought them on ecological credit. We unsustainably exploited natural systems, and now that debt is coming due.
We are seeing the debt collected via climate change, catastrophic biodiversity loss, and the destabilization of global water and food systems. You cannot sustain healthy, thriving human organisms on a degraded, dying life ground. If the soil microbiome is destroyed by monocrop chemical agriculture, the nutritional density of the food drops, which degrades the human gut microbiome, which alters human immune function. The macro and the micro are fundamentally coupled.
And the civilizational niche isn't just the physical earth anymore, it is the digital environment.
The digital world is arguably the most pervasive new civilizational determinant of health. We are structurally coupled to our technology. But the architecture of this digital niche is controlled by commercial entities whose sole fiduciary duty is to capture human attention and manipulate behavior to maximize engagement and ad revenue.
This connects directly to the paper's concept of commons enclosure. The civil commons are supposed to be shared, life-supporting systems that nobody owns. Clean air, public parks, libraries, the concept of a shared public square. They are the conditions of life. Enclosure happens when powerful entities fence off those commons, degrade them, or privatize them, forcing citizens to purchase access to what used to be a basic right.
So how do you see that enclosure operating in the digital sphere?
Well, in the early days of the internet, it felt like a chaotic, open public park. It was a shared commons. Today, the digital public square has been entirely enclosed by a handful of mega corporations. It feels like a highly surveilled, enclosed shopping mall with no exits. The architecture is intentionally designed to trigger the HPA axis. The algorithms figure out what makes you anxious, insecure, or outraged, and they feed it to you relentlessly because outrage generates the highest friction and the most clicks. It replaces deep, co-regulating social connection with shallow, anxious stimulation. It acts as a massive drain on our collective mental health, but because it's enclosed, we are basically forced to participate in it to maintain employment, read the news, or communicate with our families.
That is a pristine example of commercial and epistemic capture. And look at how perfectly it illustrates the life coherent framework. We can trace the pathology from level six straight down to level one.
Let's trace it.
Okay. The commercial decision made in a boardroom to deploy an outrage-based algorithm, that's level six, it creates a hostile digital affordance field, which is level five. This strips the user of temporal sovereignty and sleep, level four. The constant psychological provocation triggers the neuroception of threat, level three. The hypothalamus releases CRH, spiking cortisol, level 2. The chronic cortisol alters the gut microbiome and reaches the mitochondria, which sense the danger, halt ATP production, and initiate the cell danger response, leading to widespread oxidative stress and systemic inflammation, level 1.
Wow. The civilizational niche literally becomes your cellular biology. Okay, let's take a deep breath. We have zoomed all the way out from the microscopic organelles inside your cells to the overarching algorithms of the global economy. How do we make sense of this? How do we calculate whether all these interacting variables are actually keeping us healthy or breaking us down? This brings us to section 7, the master equation, exposure, repair, and margins.
Right. The entire life coherent framework ultimately distills down to the dynamic balance of those three variables.
Yeah.
Let's define them meticulously. Exposures are any forces, internal or external, that place a demand on the organism.
And as we noted earlier, exposures are not inherently evil. Lifting heavy weights is a physical exposure. Learning a complex new language is a cognitive exposure.
Exactly. When exposures are acute, predictable, and held within tolerable limits, they stimulate adaptation and growth. Hormesis. But exposures become toxic when they are chronic, overwhelming, inescapable, and unresolvable. These can be chemical, like endocrine disruptors and plastics, biological, like a latent viral load, nutritional, like diets entirely devoid of fiber, psychosocial, like navigating chronic poverty or a hostile divorce, or digital, like algorithmic outrage.
Which is where repair opportunities come into the equation.
Repair is not passive resting. It is the active, biologically expensive capacity to recover, resolve the inflammatory cascade, clear out the misfolded proteins, and rebuild tissue. Repair requires very specific conditions. 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep, nutrient-dense whole foods, prolonged contact with natural environments, deep relational safety and belonging, movement, creative expression, and somatic therapies.
And the final variable is margins. I want to move away from the typical bank account analogy here. It feels too transactional. Let's use an architectural analogy. Margins are like the structural load tolerance of a bridge combined with the floodplain surrounding a river.
I like that. Expand on it.
Think of your margins as your reserves. They are the built-in buffers that allow the system to absorb a massive shock without collapsing. Biologically, physiological margins mean having metabolic flexibility, robust vagal tone, and a diverse microbiome. Psychologically, it means having emotional bandwidth, a strong sense of purpose, and cognitive flexibility. Materially, your margins are having a robust emergency savings fund, secure housing, and comprehensive health insurance. Socially, your margins are a deep web of friends, family, and neighbors who will physically show up when disaster strikes.
That captures it perfectly. The dynamic equation is simply this. Health is sustained and life capacity expands when cumulative exposures remain within your restorative capacity and your margins. Breakdown, like chronic disease, severe burnout, cellular aging, occurs when cumulative exposures continuously exceed your repair opportunities, eating away your margins until the structure fails.
And this highlights a catastrophic failure in how public health views risk. We tend to measure exposures one at a time. The EPA measures the toxicity of one chemical in a vacuum, but in reality, exposures cluster. The paper refers to this as syndemic burden.
Syndemic burden is the realization that bad things rarely travel alone. They co-occur and amplify one another synergistically. Let's look at a concrete example. A person living below the poverty line doesn't just experience the exposure of lack of money. That lack of money means they are forced to live in housing with toxic mold, a biological exposure located near a major highway, a chemical air pollution exposure. They are forced to work night shifts, a circadian rhythm disruption exposure, experiencing ongoing discrimination, a psychosocial exposure. The exposures pile up simultaneously.
While at the exact same time, their repair opportunities are systematically stripped away. They have no time for sleep, no access to nature, and no financial margin to absorb the shock of a broken down car. True healing, therefore, isn't just handing them an inhaler for the asthma caused by the mold. The inhaler is necessary, but true healing is the active restoration of their margins. It requires structural intervention to reduce the clustered exposures and systematically increase their capacity for repair.
If we only treat the biological symptom without addressing the syndemic burden, we are essentially sending the patient right back out into the environment that made them sick in the first place, and then acting surprised when they return to the hospital.
Which begs the massive multi-trillion-dollar question. If the mathematics of exposures versus repair are this biologically obvious, why do our incredibly well-funded, highly educated medical systems and institutions keep getting it so profoundly wrong? Why are we experiencing tidal waves of chronic disease, autoimmune collapse, and systemic despair?
That brings us to our final section, why we miss it. The blind spots and capture modes. Systems fail to see structural harm because that harm gets normalized, mismeasured, culturally masked, or explicitly made profitable by the institutions in charge.
The first blind spot the paper identifies is measurement violence and metric capture. Those are aggressive terms. How does measurement become violent?
Measurement violence occurs when we reduce the profound complexity of human suffering and life capacity into a crude, two-dimensional administrative code. Metric capture is what happens when the indicator of success becomes the goal itself, regardless of reality.
Give me an example of metric capture in a hospital setting.
Imagine a hospital administration that decides the ultimate metric for efficiency is patient throughput, measuring exactly how fast they can discharge patients after a procedure to free up beds. The medical staff is pressured to optimize for this metric, so they discharge a frail elderly patient 48 hours after a major surgery. On the hospital spreadsheet, this looks like a massive success. Highly efficient, costs were minimized.
But the reality is completely different, which leads directly to the next concept, burden displacement.
Exactly. The hospital saved money, but the actual cost of care did not magically disappear. The physical and emotional burden of that early discharge was simply displaced. It was shifted off the hospital's balance sheet and dumped directly onto the patient's unpaid family members. A daughter now has to quit her job, lose her wages, forfeit her sleep, and sacrifice her own physiological margins to provide 247 complex medical care at home. The hospital system appears successful only because it artificially stops counting the costs the moment the patient rolls out the front door. It shifts the burden onto those with the absolute least structural power to refuse it.
And what's truly insidious is how we use language to cover up this displacement. The paper calls it cultural masking. We use vocabulary to make structural violence seem completely natural, or worse, like a personal failure. We call systemic intergenerational poverty a lifestyle choice. We call the exhaustion of working three precarious gig jobs a lack of hustle. We call the corporate exploitation of natural resources economic development. We call the algorithmic manipulation of our children's attention consumer engagement.
And the most dangerous piece of cultural masking is the weaponization of the word resilience.
Oh, the resilience trap. I see this everywhere in corporate culture right now.
The concept of resilience has been entirely co-opted. When it is misused, praising someone's resilience while actively refusing to change the toxic, extractive environment that is crushing them is a profound form of normalized violence. It asks human beings to quietly, infinitely adapt to preventable harm. It treats the hostile environment as fixed and unchangeable, and treats the human organism as an endless sponge that just needs to stretch further.
Let me test this with a real-world scenario. Let's say a massive multinational corporation enforces 80-hour work weeks. They track their employees' every keystroke to ensure constant productivity. They offer zero job security, effectively eliminating temporal sovereignty. But to show they care, they offer their employees a free subscription to a mindfulness and meditation app for their mental health. Is that basically burden displacement wrapped in cultural masking?
It is the textbook, pristine definition of both. It displaces the massive structural burden of systemic overwork and lack of agency onto the individual's ability to be mindful. It masks the severe structural harm of the corporate environment with the soothing, individualized language of modern wellness. It is commercial capture at its finest. The system generates massive profit from your physical and emotional exhaustion and then attempts to sell you the individualized coping mechanism.
It's infuriating once you see the architecture of it. You can't unsee it. Okay, we need to bring all of these massive concepts together. We have covered an immense landscape today. We started at level one with the inner biology of the cell, the mitochondria sensing environmental danger, leaking ATP, and initiating the solugenic healing cycle.
We move through the HPA axis in the microbiome, mapping how the brain and the gut process structural threats. We explore the timeline of the life course, showing how trauma and adversity embed themselves epigenetically into our biological baseline.
We looked at the affordance fields of our neighborhoods, examining how time, scarcity, and lack of agency physically disable our repair mechanisms. And finally, we zoomed out to the civilizational niche, exposing how algorithmic capture and economic burden displacement turn structural violence into chronic cellular inflammation.
The profound demand of Dr. Saley's life coherent framework is that it asks us to hold all of this reality at once. It flatly refuses to separate the cell from the civilization.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? It means stop beating yourself up for failing to out-willpower a system designed to exhaust you. Health isn't just on your shoulders. It's a co-creation between your cellular biology and the civilization you live in. Your job is to identify your margins and protect your repair opportunities. Deep sleep, genuine connection, time and nature, and meaning-making, these are not frivolous luxuries. They are fundamental, non-negotiable biological imperatives.
And at a broader collective level, we have a profound responsibility. We must begin demanding that our systems, our medical systems, our economic systems, our urban planning, and our digital spaces become answerable to the Life Value Foundation. We must build societies that protect the civil commons and design affordance fields that make it infinitely easier to heal than to be harmed. We have to stop normalizing preventable violence.
Which leaves me with a final provocative thought for you to mull over as we close out this deep dive. Right now, as a society, we spend billions searching for the next miracle pill to extend human life. We want to biohack our way to immortality. But based on the Life Coherent framework, what if the ultimate medical intervention of the 21st century isn't a chemical at all? What if the greatest cure for our modern chronic disease epidemic is simply the radical redesign of time, giving people their temporal sovereignty back so their bodies can finally finish the work of healing? Until next time, keep diving deep.
It has been a truly remarkable exploration. Thank you.
Take care, everyone. And remember that X-ray machine we talked about at the very beginning. Sometimes the most critical things affecting our cellular health will never show up on a medical scan. They show up in our daily schedules, the design of our neighborhoods, and the depth of our connections. Protect your margins. Catch you on the next deep dive.